Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. In the wake of Hurricane Andrew, South Dade County, Florida, will be rebuilding for years. One of the most significant sites destroyed was the Turkey Point Nuclear Power Station. Greenpeace spokesman Harvey Wasserman says, "We were lucky."
We believe basically that this hurricane showed all too clearly how truly dangerous nuclear power is. Had there been a meltdown in the middle of this hurricane, it would have been a catastrophe beyond even what occurred at Chernobyl.
Also this time, a wind farm competes with a nuclear facility in Washington State, and Senator Tim Wirth looks back and ahead as he bids us farewell. For now, The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. The rain was torrential, the winds at cosmic speed. Trees ripped from the ground and houses flattened. In the darkness and the fury of the storm, a nuclear power station was destroyed. On the night of August 24th, Hurricane Andrew swept in from the Atlantic and crushed most of South Dade County, Florida. In its path was the 1,300-megawatt Turkey Point Nuclear Power Station, owned by FPNL, Florida Power and Light. From Miami, Harvey Wasserman, senior advisor to the Atmosphere and Energy Campaign of Greenpeace, describes the scene.
Well, a number of buildings around the reactor were destroyed. There was a $10 million structure there housing about $80 million worth of spare parts that was totally destroyed along with its inventory. A health physics building was destroyed, a water tower was destroyed, and other ancillary damage was done to the plant, to the point that we feel that if Florida Power and Light were to try and bring Turkey Point back to pre-hurricane status, it would cost at least $100 million and probably a good deal more.
Turkey Point generates 1,292 total megawatts from its two reactors. Wasserman says the plant is known to have been out of touch with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for at least an hour after the storm hit, a violation of code.
The sirens were definitely knocked out. Also, the radiation monitoring equipment off-site was definitely knocked out. That means it's possible that radiation could have escaped during the hurricane that was not monitored because, again, contrary to regulation, they lost these monitors, and as far as we know, based on that, there may have been radiation leak. And again, we need to have full access to all records and all personnel before we can make a final judgment on that. But it is definitely true that the sirens were gone and that the radiation monitoring equipment was gone.
Greenpeace estimates that were a meltdown to occur, even under fair weather conditions, 50,000 people would be killed and $50 billion property damage sustained in a 70-mile radius. Wasserman says with the monitoring and alarm systems knocked out during the storm, a radiation leak could have happened and the public would never have known.
And furthermore, what the hurricane definitively showed was that it was impossible to evacuate. In the midst of the hurricane, I don't think it takes any great rocket scientist to figure out, looking at the pictures from Andrew, that had a meltdown occurred during the hurricane, the people in the area would have been absolutely obliterated. They had enough trouble dealing with the wind to have to try and get out from under a meltdown in the middle of that is just an impossibility. And it underscores the folly of building nuclear plants overall, but certainly building them in an earthquake, in a hurricane zone.
Wasserman says Greenpeace has so far been unable to obtain documents from FPNL showing what happened and in what sequence that night at the plant. Our attempts to obtain the information have so far been unproductive as well. FPNL has been unavailable for comment. Wasserman says Greenpeace is calling on Florida Senator Bob Graham, chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Nuclear Regulation, to conduct a full investigation. For now, Wasserman says,
"We understand that Florida Power and Light is moving ahead to bring at least one reactor at Turkey Point up to criticality. We think this is irresponsible, bordering on the insane. There's absolutely no justification in terms of demand for bringing Turkey Point, either of those reactors, back online at this point. The grid itself is largely destroyed. The demand is down significantly because of the 60,000 homes that have been virtually destroyed. There is only one possible justification that they have for bringing Turkey Point back online, and that's political. They want to make a point. But the reality is that they're jeopardizing the health and safety as well as the economic well-being of all the people of South Florida just to prove some kind of political point by bringing these plants back to criticality. And we think it's the height of irresponsibility.
Senator Graham has not returned our calls as of airtime either. Turkey Point reactor is nearly 20 years old now and has shown similar signs of aging as were seen in the now closed Yankee Row plant in western Massachusetts. According to information provided by the Center for Nuclear Responsibility in Miami, Turkey Point is already the most fined reactor in the nation, with FPNL having paid $1.5 million in fines for violations of NRC regulations. Wasserman says there is a movement building now to keep Turkey Point closed and to use the opportunity of mass destruction in South Dade County to rebuild the power grid using sustainable, renewable systems.
We know that with the 60,000 homes that hopefully will be rebuilt, that if solar water heaters and photovoltaic cells for generating electricity are installed in the construction of those homes, and if the appliances and the electric lights that are put back in those homes are energy efficient, that a very substantial amount of the demand that allegedly justifies the use of Turkey Point, that demand can be gotten rid of. We know that with the $100 million plus that would be put back into Turkey Point to bring it back online, that money could go put South Florida well down the road to rebuilding along lines that will give it a decentralized, weather-safe energy system that's based on renewables, the sun, and biomass energy, and not put the people dependent on a central grid again. And that's one of the major disasters that's accompanied this hurricane, is that people have lost their power. If they were in a decentralized mode, they wouldn't be reliant on a grid of wires strung out that are totally vulnerable to the winds, and also on central generating facilities like Turkey Point, which could have caused infinitely more damage than even the hurricane alone.
Harvey Wasserman, nuclear energy advisor to Greenpeace, speaking to us from Miami. He says we may have just been lucky this time that a meltdown did not start. He says that what Hurricane Andrew illustrates is the danger facing the nation's nuclear power stations, whether from hurricanes, earthquakes, or, as was the case with Yankee Row in Massachusetts, a lightning strike. This is Bruce Robertson. A California wind power company is looking to expand into the Northwest. This spring, they proposed a wind farm for Montana, then unveiled plans for another facility in southeastern Washington state near the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. As producer Charles Compton discovered, reactions to the wind farm are mixed in this traditional nuclear community.
Today we have from U.S. Wind Power, Steve Steinhauer, who is the Director of Lands and Permits for U.S. Wind Power.
Steve Steinhauer speaks to the skeptical members of the Pasco Chamber of Commerce. He's been instrumental in picking Hanford for his company's next windmill farm. U.S. Wind Power operates 7,000 windmills at Altamont Pass, just east of San Francisco. After his lunchtime talk, Steinhauer was asked by a Pasco merchant about the local benefits. Her opinion seems to mirror local reaction to the project. Since the project may only employ a half dozen people, she wanted to know what was in this project for area residents. Steinhauer says U.S. Wind Power is not accustomed to buying support.
Well, with all due respect, you're assuming that the benefits here are going to be small, and I believe that they're going to be a lot more substantial than that. And so far as subsidizing it, we have never, in any of the plants we put up, had to buy approval of a project.
U.S. Wind Power wants to put 140 windmills atop Hanford's tallest peak, Rattlesnake Mountain, land now owned by farmers and the Energy Department. The farm will cost at least $40 million to build and could supply 35,000 homes with electricity. The communities nearest Hanford and the proposed wind farm are called the Tri-Cities. U.S. Wind Power has three reasons for going there: the educated workforce, easy access to the Northwest power grid, and most importantly, the winter winds.
And it turns out that the southeast corner of Washington has one of the very best wind resources in all of the state, and Rattlesnake Mountain appears to be the best wind resource for a winter peaking wind site. And that happens to coincide with the heavy wintertime demands for energy here.
While no one will admit it on the record, some people in the Tri-Cities worry that the windmills could compete with nuclear power. Dr. Michael Fox is a spokesperson for the American nuclear industry and a founder of the pro-nuclear group Hanford Family.
If you're going to get very much energy from windmills, you're going to have huge amounts of land covered. And I believe that there's better ways of producing electricity than paving the mountaintops with windmills.
Hanford has only one commercial reactor, and according to Fox, its generating capacity is many times the total power that could be produced atop Rattlesnake Mountain. That mountain is a very prominent feature in the Tri-Cities. The butte is bald, brown, and big enough to dominate the community's western landscape. Many residents in the basin below worry that a wall of windmills will spoil the mountain's sunsets. They're also concerned about the noise of swooshing propellers and the hazard they pose to birds. Dr. Michael Fox.
These windmills in Altamont Pass are killing a couple of hundred eagles and hawks per year. You can count the bodies. And we have a very diverse wildlife here, including golden eagles and a flourishing migratory population of bald eagles, as well as other raptors. And I don't think we need to abuse them with windmills on Rattlesnake Mountain.
U.S. Wind Power admits that every 100 windmills kills an average 4 birds per year, but they're working with conservation groups on possible solutions. And, adds Steinauer, there are ways to muffle and camouflage windmills so they don't sour the sunsets. John Lindsay is president of the Tri-Cities Industrial Development Council. He recently toured U.S. Wind Power's California facility. Lindsay is trying to steer the local economy away from its dependence on Hanford. He wonders if the Tri-Cities can afford to dismiss wind power technology. Lindsay chose his words carefully because his board hasn't decided yet if it will support U.S. wind power.
If we view ourselves as an energy research and development community, should we have the arrogance of simply saying, no, we only want to look at nuclear, or should we look at a balanced energy approach?
Meanwhile, there will be a series of public hearings in the Tri-Cities. The Energy Department must okay the wind farm because it owns part of the land. It must also be approved by the local utility district. That means it will be at least 2 years before the turbines can start turning on Rattlesnake Mountain. For the High Plains News Service, I'm Charles Compton.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana.
It's time to leave when you can still hit a curveball. I mean, leave when you're still hitting 300. You don't get picked up in the expansion draft somewhere.
Senator Tim Wirth, at the close of the 102nd Congress, the Colorado senator, a champion of some of the most significant environmental legislation in the last 20 years, has decided to call it quits.
Well, life is complicated, and political life is doubly so. I mean, it's a very, very complicated decision, but it has a lot of roots to it. One, I found myself very frustrated with campaign financing and the constant money chase. I was about to go into an incredibly negative campaign. I've had 7 campaigns, all of which were nasty and close, and I just didn't want to do it again. And if you don't want to do it, you shouldn't be running. It's not fair to your constituents. Third, I find that the Senate doesn't work very well. I was very frustrated by the budget impasse and so many other things, like a lot of posturing and polarization of politics. And ultimately, I didn't like what it was doing to me. You know, I found myself getting angry and frustrated and so on, and that's not a good way to live. But so I said to myself, hey, come on, you know, let somebody else come in and do this.
But there is a certain amount of power and opportunity that a political figure has in Congress or as an administrative figure. Are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to give up that sort of the opportunity to do things?
Well, that was the reason for staying in, was that you do have a certain amount of leverage and so on, but I think it's fair to say that most people in public life stay too long, you know, and it's a good thing to turn over. It's a good thing to, as a friend of mine, the president of World Bank, Lou Preston, said, get repotted. You know, I'm about to be repotted. It'll be good for me, and I think it'll be good for my constituents as well. Turnover and change is good. New growth is good. You know, that's what spring's all about. It brings new growth and new hope and new vision and so on.
As you look back over the 20 years of your public service in the House and in the Senate, do you look back essentially pleased or dismayed at the work that was accomplished?
I have a mixed reaction. I'm very proud of some of the things that I just took on and decided to do. The communications revolution when I was in the House was largely led by the subcommittee that I chaired, the change in the Bell system, the advent of cable television, satellite broadcasting. You know, that's created a real change in the marketplace of ideas in America, and that was good. In the Senate, I've been very pleased with some of the environmental achievements, you know, saving the Arctic and Alaska from drilling, stopping the rape of the Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska, having an impact on our energy policy, getting a wilderness bill in Colorado. You know, there's just a number of things that I'm very proud of doing.
Wirth was elected first to the House of Representatives in 1974, serving in the Senate since 1986. During his two decades in Washington, Wirth helped craft the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, two of the most significant legislative initiatives of the late 20th century. Also during his tenure on Capitol Hill, Wirth had occasion to cast several controversial votes. In a bill to create 600,000 new acres of federal wilderness in Colorado, Wirth agreed to a compromise to leave water use decisions up to the state. Environmentalists fear this will give developers too much access to the water. Wirth also voted not to increase grazing fees for cattle on federal land. He also voted to allow continued rock mining on federal land. He also expresses a controversial position on nuclear energy. He says he is not flip-flopping by casting his votes on these matters. In the political arena, you give some to get some.
You know, if in fact we are, as we should be, concerned about global climate change, then we have to say to ourselves, well, what are our energy sources going to be? Global climate change is largely driven by the burning of fossil fuels and the putting carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere. That comes from oil, coal, and so on. Well, what are the alternatives going to be to that? If we don't want to warm the climate dramatically and therefore change the ecosystems, change our whole biological base, we're going to have to find other energy sources. Where are they going to come from? Well, the two ones that are going to be clean are either solar or potentially nuclear. Now, I'm no advocate for nuclear power tomorrow because we have a lot of problems to solve, waste and safety and cost and so on, but we have to do the research now. Now, a lot of people in the environmental community have what I would call a nuclear neuralgia, you know, that you use the N-word and you're a bad guy. And I say, now, wait a minute. You know, let's at least do the research on these nuclear programs to see if, in fact, we're going to be able to make nuclear work long term. I can't tell you if it's going to work by the year 2010 or 2020, but if we don't start the research today, we'll never know.
Wirth attended the United Nations Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro as an official government delegate. As did many who attended, were quoted as saying, Wirth announced ahead of time his belief that the summit would be a critical gathering, with a lot of hopes riding on the outcome. After the summit, many expressed disappointment. Wirth says the meeting was a success beyond his wildest imagination, bringing together so many nations for something other than military purposes. The real test now, he says, will be putting the agreements into action. For this, a lot depends on the United States.
The world is looking to us for leadership. The rest of the world obviously has to participate, but if we don't do it, they won't. It was very striking when Al Gore and I were in New York watching and participating in some of the negotiations prior to Rio. The world was asking us to lead. The developing countries, the G77, the poor countries around the world, came to the United States and said, please lead, and we didn't. The developed countries, the G7, the Europeans, the Japanese, came to us and asked us to lead, and we dropped the ball. The island nations, you know, who are the ones that if there's global climate change and rising sea levels, they're eliminated, they came to us and asked us to lead, and we didn't. I mean, it was, in many ways, it was so disappointing to see the United States abdicating the responsibility that it has as the remaining superpower and the lead nation in the world.
While he may have other opportunities for political leadership in the future, perhaps a cabinet position, for example, for now, Wirth, known for white water rafting as much as speaking in the Senate, is looking forward to private life.
And what I'd really like to do is have a sabbatical leave. You know, I've been doing this for 20 years with these, you know, very close, very painful, very difficult elections for a long period of time. I'd like to have a garden. I haven't had a garden for 20 years, you know. I'd like to ski every ski area in Colorado. I haven't done that. You know, I want to go to Italy. I've never spent any time in Italy. I love Roman history and run a few, you know, there's some rivers. I want to run the Tachinchini River in Alaska and a lot of things I want to do.
Colorado Senator Tim Wirth resigning after nearly 20 years in Congress, speaking to us on the banks of the Attaquechee River in Woodstock, Vermont, where he was on a fact-finding tour. This is Bruce Robertson. Recently, the Environmental Protection Agency decided not to decide. Under pressure from the Competitiveness Council, headed by Vice President Quayle, the EPA considered changing the way hazardous waste is classified, enabling 90% of it to be landfilled along with other solid waste. Pressured from environmental groups and several key political leaders, the EPA decided against changing its policy, at least for now. End of story, right? Well, as you must suspect, there is more to the story. At least, this is what Thomas Jorling says. Jorling is New York State Commissioner in the Department of Environmental Conservation. Along with Montana Senator Max Baucus, Colorado Governor Roy Romer, and other key environmental political leaders, Mr. Jorling had scheduled a Washington, D.C. press conference to object to the reclassifying when the EPA reversed itself. He joins us on the line now. Mr. Jorling, what about this assessment? Is it fair to say, from your perspective, that the real story here is that what this says about the way decisions are being made in Washington?
It's very political, and it's obvious that President Bush has no commitment to anything. If he says he's the environmental president and then he has his forces act to deregulate, then he switches back, it's just hard to predict where this person would take this country. Here you had unanimous opposition from the states, Republican and Democrat alike. You had the opposition of the industries that are involved in the management of hazardous waste. You had the environmental community and the states all on the same side in unanimous opposition to this very crass attempt to unravel the regulation of hazardous waste. They tried it. It would have happened but for the scrutiny that is now being given it and for the strength that Administrator Riley finally feels he has in the election season. But if we have four more years of the Bush administration, then they'll flip back to the other. And the interesting thing about this is that the responsible industries, certainly those responsible industries that we have in New York, do not support this kind of deregulation effort. They don't want to have to face the public and say, well, we're going to manage this stuff now and just throw it in landfills when previously we've had to manifest it and send it to highly regulated hazardous waste facilities. They don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you've said, for now anyway, the proposed regulations have been rescinded. But again, more specifically, how would a community have been affected had these changes been put into effect? What would citizens have been able to see, and how would they have been affected?
Well, all of a sudden, 90% of what is now being managed carefully as hazardous waste would have been deregulated. And so the material that comes off of plant sites all over, in this instance, the state of New York, would start winding up in dumps and sanitary landfills. It wouldn't have to go to specially protected facilities. So what even EPA's analysis showed that it would produce hazardous waste sites that would then require remediation costing billions of dollars, and that it would have caused the contamination of drinking water for a very large segment of the American population.
As we said, the proposed changes have been rescinded, as Jorling says, at least for now. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the show. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 144. That's 1-800-767-1929. Program number 144, The Environment Show. Address your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson, hoping to return next week with my voice intact. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.